and welcome to the Trash Tapes Podcast as part of the Enigmatic Productions Network. If you love bad cinema and incredible deep dives into cult film, then you have come to the right place. So if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can do so by donating some funds to our Buy Me a Coffee website, along with the Acast supporter feature. All of these can be found in the description below. And now, on with the show.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to this very fabulous episode of the Trash Tapes. My name is Johan, your host and the inflictor of pride this time round, as I am joined by the There Queer Podcast on one of two very special Pride Month episodes coming out this June. These two episodes will all have links to donations to Stonewall and Mine charities below to help those within the LGBTQ plus community get the support they need. Even in what could be seen as forward-thinking times, there are still people, places, and even laws around the world that are homophobic, biphobic, transphobic, and genuinely against the rights and needs of all those in the community. This hate is still out there, and it is why events like Pride Month are so important. It is to remind others that we're still here, and that they need to stand up for queer rights. Our rights. Human rights. Same as when we did the Pink Flamingos episode last year, I have made a small donation to each of these groups, and all future profits from these episodes will be donated there too. I hope that all of you can do the same and show your support. And now, let's step away from the hate and embrace the love as we're about to explore Xanadu. Get your skates on!
To experience trash cinema. Oh my God.
And welcome to another episode of the Trash Tapes. One man's trash is another man's treasure. I'm your host, Johan Chapal, and the inflictor of pain. And today I'm not joined by my usual victim and DJ, Edward Harvey, because this is a very special episode. This is considerably our big Pride Month episode. And I thought, who else could I have on than the two Liams of Their Queer Podcast? Hi there, introduce yourselves.
Hi.
I'm a big homosexual. and my name, I'm so just to simplify things, as there are two homos called Liam on here today. Yes. I'm Liam J, but you can call me LJ if it makes things easier.
I'm Liam B, and please don't call me LB because I sound like a shit pencil.
Liam Banks, as it were. You've been here before. You've been here before.
I have. Yeah, you've already popped my cherry a couple of times on this podcast. Yeah, so I should be used to this, but I'm not.
You know what? Because half the time I always say, hey, I want you on. You literally give the tone of, okay, what is it? And the two times I've had you on, though, have predominantly been about things with body parts involved.
We had killer vaginas, and then we had weird conjoined
tumor
twins. Yeah, it was all very, very, very strange. This, I, I mean, there are body parts involved in this, maybe, but just not what you'd expect from this podcast. I don't know.
I'm now questioning what movie you actually watched.
Yeah, me too.
In Xenadu?
Did you find one with a Z?
That's a crossover. That's a crossover. Xena and Xanadu.
Yes! Yep.
Lucy Lawless just coming in and
just rollerblading it through women.
Now that's a movie, everybody. Before we actually go into the detail, do you guys want to talk about your podcast in particular? So it'd be nice to have, for people who haven't had a chance to listen to it, do you want to talk about it?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. So Their Queer Podcast is a podcast where two homos called Liam get together each week, stick our rollerblades on, go skating through the world of horror, look at it through a queer lens. Some ELO might be involved.
let's just confirm this isn't usually about these sorts of films. We're probably usually a little bit more campy horror than just camp or whatever this is. I mean, I spoke to you last night, Liam, and I do agree this is a genre bending film. Bending being the key word.
You can etch this on my gravestone. I want a Spotify QR code that will take you to a link of this movie when you visit my gravestone.
Love it. Love it.
I can just imagine it. It's like saying, I always want to find out how it was like. Oh, there's a QR code. Oh, and it summed it up completely.
Nailed it. But yeah, essentially that's what we do. We just discuss horror films through a queer lens every month. And
we are unofficially members of the Kelly Rowland fan club.
Friday! Yeah. Yes. I love
how
you
pops up every episode.
In every episode, she pops up. I wonder one day.
She might make a guest appearance.
I'm wondering if one day she will respond. I would love that.
Me too.
It's going to happen. Let's manifest it.
Obviously, you've mentioned already that you're mostly doing horror movies and stuff like that. So there's a reason why we're doing this movie. We're doing flippin' Xanadu. Now, the reason is actually, it's because Liam James, it's your fault on this, really.
I take no part in this.
I mentioned a while ago that I said I'm looking for suggestions for good movies to do. And then you mentioned Xanadu on one of my things. And so like, wait a minute. And say, how do you think it's good? I said to myself, like, if that's the case, you need to come on this podcast and defend it.
Happily.
And the thing is, and I said to myself, I said, you know what, I might as well have the other Liam on, because the last two times I put in something completely horrific. And I think, you know what, maybe this is the palate cleanser in comparison to everything else I've thrown him into the deep end.
I think this was probably the scariest thing I've had to watch for you, Johan, so... So no, there was no palate cleansing with this one, I'm afraid.
Oh.
I'm going to say, I think there's going to be a variety of opinions on this episode, which is good. And I will be respectful of the film because I do know how special it is for you, the Liam. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I tell everyone it's an awful film, but it's also one of the greatest films you will ever see. So
it has to be experienced. It's like one of those things that has to be seen to be believed and heard.
I see it once a month.
It's an assault.
It's literally an assault.
Open your eyes and hear the magic. Universal Pictures announces the most dazzling romantic musical fantasy in years. Xanadu. Starring Olivia Newton-John, Michael Beck, and Gene Kelly. It's a love story about a boy and girl from two very different worlds who no one can keep apart. It It's a spectacular entertainment that will transport you beyond your dreams. Xanadu, where time stops and the magic never ends. Xanadu.
There was bits last night and I was like, I'm going to try and watch it as an outsider, and I'm going to get rid of all the sentimentality I have attached to this film and try and watch it as an outsider. And there was bits I was like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, obviously, feel free to cut this out, Johan, but I watched it with my other half because I hadn't actually watched it until actually recently, like for the first time. Yeah. And there was a bit where I looked over at him and I just went, oh, for God's sake, we've still got the animated bit to get through.
how can you sigh at the Don Bluth animated thing? Right, anyway, let's calm ourselves down. I feel like we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
I'm getting heated,
We're getting hot and bothered.
This is the end of the They're Queer podcast.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that Olivia Newton-John ruined your friendship. Anyway, right, so just for anyone else listening out there who has absolutely no idea what a Xanadu is. So Xanadu is a 1980 American musical fantasy film written by Richard Christian Donis and also directed by Robert Greenwald, also starring Olivia Newton-John, Michael Beck, and Gene Kelly.
Yes!
Yes, Gene.
How long have you been... Sorry, I'm so sorry. How long have you been sitting on that one, Liam?
Yeah. I've been sitting on it a good while.
Yes, Gene.
Yes, Gene.
Yes, Gene. You've been waiting for this exact moment. You saw Gene Kelly going, I'm going to make that exact fucking joke. The thing is, as it being a musical anyway, obviously one getting Gene Kelly on is like the ultimate thing, but you have to talk about the tune. So obviously it's music done by Olivia Newton-John by Electric Light Orchestra, sung a little bits by Cliff Richard at one point, and the Tubes. So there's quite a large variety of proper, I'm not going to lie, before we get into any material, I'm saying some of the tunes do slap. They really...
Absolutely.
Some of the tunes really slap, I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically is renowned as being a huge box office disappointment. And just to make this clear, I'm not sure if you know this, this is the movie, we're, alongside the Village People movie, Can't Stop the Music, inspired the Razzies.
Cultural reset.
So Xanadu and Can't Stop the Music, the creator of the Razzies saw this in a double bill and said,
oh, good God.
I need to make the Razzies.
I'd die to see that as a double bill in a cinema. I really would.
I'm not going to lie. I think a lot of other people would die. The cheesiest thing ever. So it much is. Cheese, you might as well dip yourself in fondue and call yourself a nacho. You know, that is how cheese works in this case.
I can get behind that.
I've got a story about that.
There's a kink in there somewhere. But yeah, that's predominantly the case. There's a couple of other interesting bits as well. Like a personal favorite of yours, Kenny Ortega, this was his first piece of choreography, basically. So basically the man who eventually ended up doing Hocus Pocus choreographed this movie.
And which, the choreography in this film is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, there are highlights to this movie. Like, we're not saying like, oh, inspired the Razzies, it must be all shit. No, but it has some great bits in it. But there are also some not so great bits as we kind of go along as we go. So let's look at the, I'm going to look for you some bits of the production. If you guys know any history of this, I'm looking particularly at you, basically, Liam, that if you've got any sort of facts about this, you're very welcome to throw in as I go. So the movie was originally conceived as a relatively low budget roller disco picture, but they realized at a certain point in time that there was four other roller disco movies filming at the same time. Four of them, okay? So they said, we need to do something a bit different. Hence why they started rattling over and trying to get Gene Kelly involved, because they wanted to do the thing of the 40s versus the 80s and just mash it together to make whatever the hell this is. So they tried to put a spin on things. Earlier versions had several different things going on, including some very interesting casting. So,
yes.
Okay. Right, so this is my favourite thing, first of all. Sonny, in particular, was going to be someone completely different than the person we got there. The person we got was Michael Beck, who basically was the guy from the Warriors.
Warriors! Warriors! Come out to play!
He's quite literally just... Oh, God, he's just hair, right?
Oh, he is. Like, he absolutely is, but it's hair.
Yeah, hair and no talent.
He has really good legs as well, I noticed this time around. Like, yeah, really good.
He suddenly goes, huh? The funny thing is, apparently, while everyone else had the audition, when several people were... He didn't have to go for an audition, apparently. He just got it, which I don't know what that means. He's just like, fine, we couldn't get the rest of them. So the others were, number one, Olivia Newton-John actually did suggest at one point that Mel Gibson was going to play Sonny.
Imagine.
Lord of mercy.
Mad Max Mel Gibson was going to be in this movie.
Oh dear.
Wow. It wouldn't have aged well.
The thing is, you'd know there'd be more leather involved if
Exactly. I wouldn't be opposed to that. But
I'm back on board now.
Yeah.
The producers were really trying hard to actually get John Travolta to get back on the role of Sonny. Because obviously they had the thing with Grease and said, you know what, let's do this again. Because, it made all the money. But he was busy. John Travolta was busy at the time. He was busy doing Urban Cowboy.
Busy.
And busy. And also, he was just about to start on his... In on his own other weird disco-y movie, Staying Alive, which is the sequel to Saturday Night Fever, which was directed by Sylvester Stallone. God, this
incredible.
There's just a lot going on, and I mean, I think incredible. This film just encapsulates that for sure.
I just love the fact how everything kind of spawned out into these different branches, and each of the responses is just campier as it goes as you dig deeper down the rabbit hole.
I just love the fact that there were four other roller skate disco movies in production at this time, and then they were like, "Do you know what? We need a fifth."
we need to fix this.
And absolutely, why not?
But the funny thing was that this was at the literally it was 19. This already started filming around late 1978, right? So started film around then. So disco was big, right? They didn't know that disco would literally collapse in 1980. So they made all the disco movies because they thought, you know what, it's still hip, I guess.
It's such a shame. I mean, I thought that, you know, especially obviously the whole premise of the film is about them building this club called Xanadu, which is going to be a roller disco heaven. And I was like thinking, in the real world, this went out of business probably a year later.
I think they were clever enough, though, because they had a muse on their side to think, what's next?
Yeah.
So well, I'm already going ahead.
Trying to think what it turned
into. They were a roller disco, but they never did disco music. So
this is fair. They did everything else but disco in a disco musical.
Every other genre but disco is in there.
I know, right? Which means it survived. I mean, not going to lie, the club would have lasted, but it would have been like a weird mishmash. Like, it literally would have been a themed night every night to keep the wave of the disco rolling. Because as we start going into the musical numbers in particular, they couldn't really pick out which one they wanted. So it's a budget, especially near the end where everyone was just wearing zoot suits. Half people were wearing zoot suits. Half people were looking like punks. Other people were wearing latex. They couldn't make up their mind.
Appealing to every aspect of the kink community. In that last scene.
I think that was their idea of like pure, like every demographic's represented here. Every kind of person's here. Because of this, they were able to get Gene Kelly on. And Gene Kelly did do his own choreography. But he was actually kind of shy about it, to the point that all the scenes that he was dancing with half the time, other than the one in the, not really it's dancing, but other than the one in the mall kind of shopping area, everything else was shot after filming and with a very small, limited crew. He kind of felt a little bit, I think he was worried about his old age and wondering, he didn't want to look too bad And then feel almost embarrassed in front of a larger crew. Mm. So he purposely wanted to do something a lot smaller, which it shows, it just really shows that for him, this was like, this is going to be my last big break.
Yeah.
This is my last hurrah. And it's sad a little bit that it's Xanadu. There are other people, there are other movies have done this, you know, like how Raul Julia's last movie is Street Fighter the movie, mm-hmm. for example.
What a film, though. What a film.
What a movie. I love that what film a way so much. To end a career.
Of course.
I Googled how old he was when he did this, because obviously there's, particularly towards the end when he's doing the skating, and I was blown away by how old he was doing all of that. I mean, I'd struggle to do that now at 29, so the fact that he was
the man had vigor,
absolutely,
still as fit as ever in this film.
He was so, dancing around looking so gorgeous,
so
I first watched this film when I was about 3 or 4 years old with my great nan. Even then, like, everybody in the film wants you to fancy Sunny, but I didn't. I was like, I'm a Danny girl.
And you know what? And you know, it's weird, isn't it? Because we'll get to everyone there in a minute. But yeah, Sunny is, like I mentioned at the beginning, he's just hair. That's all he is.
It's like, there's one bit where he's skating through, like, on the promenade or wherever it is. And his hair goes so flat because it's obviously like a wide shot and they're just filming him in public. And then the next scene when he just wheels in front of the mural, he is coiffed for the gods. It's everything.
Quite literally.
Literally, yeah. Absolutely.
See what you did there?
Yeah, I see.
But yeah, and it's funny because when he and Olivia Newton-John are having conversations with her, I'm sitting there going, it's literally like looking at petrified wood trying to rub each other. It's like, wow, it's the look at these fantastic lawn chairs just trying to converse.
Hello.
Hey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You scared the hell out of me.
I'm sorry if I disturbed you. I tried to be quiet.
How long have you been standing there?
Just a few seconds. Should I go?
Oh, no, stay.
You paint beautifully.
This is the first time I've cared about what I painted in a long time.
That's a shame. It must be frustrating to waste your talents on things that don't really matter to you.
Yeah. I met a guy the other day. He told me I should take long lunch hours.
A guy?
Yeah, someone I met at the beach. He's got this crazy idea. He wants to build a club. And he asked me if I'd help him find a place. All the real estate agents in this town, he asked me, right?
That's such a crazy idea. You've got a good eye.
That's what he said.
The thing is, all the choreography parts were most... That was a centerpiece, right? But everything else was kind of planned out on the day. Apparently, things involving the script... Olivia Newton-John did say that the script was ongoing as she was there, which, to be honest, looking at the dialogue scenes, it makes all the sense in the universe.
My biggest gripe with the film is because the choreography is major, but the shots don't do the choreography justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was going to say with that, yeah.
That's my biggest gripe, but I could now, knowing everything was made on the fly, it makes sense.
Well, I very much thought, like, they had the songs were great, the dancing was great, the numbers were great. Did they just kind of mishmash a story around this and they didn't really actually know where they were going?
Well, they had the bare bones of a story because it's a pseudo remake.
I was going to say, is it the 1947 film Down to Earth starring Rita Hayworth?
Yes.
I saw that it was loosely inspired by.
Yeah, of which she starred in another film with Gene Kelly not long afterwards, where his character is called Danny Maguire. So it's just, like,
it's all going full circle.
There's a whole expanded universe.
Oh my God, is a Xanadu expanded universe?
I'm going to write the comic.
Do it!
Please do. Xanadu, it's waiting to happen. You heard it here first, folks.
Oh my God, ladies and gentlemen, someone hire this man.
Xanadu, this time it's personal.
No, it should have been Xanadu Electric Boogaloo. Of course it is.
Yeah, Xanadu, sorry. This time it's rollerblades.
Yeah.
Oh, you see, we're already thinking about sequels.
I feel like this could work well, though. You know, like how you get like kids' TV shows being made into horror films. This could definitely work well as a horror movie, 100%. I think this would be great, actually. really. Just,
it's like the muse is not really, the muse is just actually not really a muse. It's just there
like,
to be
what if you
horrific.
Get like a bit of a dick muse, like sabotaging people, not trying to encourage people.
Well, I have a fun fact about that. This was eventually made into a Broadway show. And the Broadway show changes the story a little bit. The Broadway show was actually a satire of the film, but also an adaptation of the film. So it's honestly, it was universally like praised. It was loved, like the kind of opposite
the
of
Broadway
film.
Show. Yeah,
but in the Broadway show, like the dynamics change. Danny's character's a twat, which is I don't like. But Kira is a muse who puts on a fake Australian accent. So throughout the thing, it's somebody putting on a really fake Australian accent, and it really shows in when they sing Suddenly. It starred Cheyenne Jackson as Sunny. the reason why I said dickhead muses is that the villain, the villains of the piece are actually two of Kira's sisters played by men in drag.
Why not? Absolutely, why not?
And so it's got all the music numbers you'd want in there. Like, it's all in there. Like, the basic part of the story's in there, but they change it to make it a bit more parody and a bit more funny. It goes in on the Greek mythology as well. It's incredible. If you get a chance, look up the synopsis, and you can watch the full performance on YouTube. Hypothetically.
there you go. Everyone go out and look at this. But I'm intrigued.
I went to see it when it came to London. And I left the theatre like jumping for joy. I was actually, at first I was really angry because I'm like, what have they done to my favourite film? They've butchered it. But then afterwards I was like, I really appreciate what they did there.
Was Cheyenne Jackson in it when you saw it?
Yes. Played Sunny.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. Oh my God.
Cool. Very nice.
This is the thing. I think it had to be parodied at some point. Like because it's like some other movies turned musicals, right? For example, like Legally Blonde, for example. It's not following the movie entirely, it's poking fun of itself slightly, and it works better. Yeah. Same with Heathers in the same way as well. It has a little bit of tongue in cheek with it. You kind of need to. Because the movie's its own thing. Plus, Xanadu is renownedly shit. So you might as well say, like, you might as well point a little bit and say, you know what? We know the movie was a bit rubbish. We know it is. And that will do its favor, you know.
I'll tell you, a credit to the musical is one of the plot lines involves a magic pair of leg warmers.
Wow.
Yes.
If that's not like testament to you should go and watch this or read about it, then I don't know what else is.
That's a full blown selling point, everybody.
Absolutely.
I'm sold. Basically, the movie did, as you probably would suss out, did terribly in terms of reception. Universal actually cancelled a lot of the press screens for Xanadu because they were not confident in it at all. I think they were looking back at it at the rushes and looking how things were afterwards and kind of looking how Olivia Newton-John changed accent four times in the movie and just couldn't pick one. People say like Variety called it a stupendously bad film whose only salvage is the music, which is all fair. Roger Ebert gave the film's 2 stars, describing it as a mushy and limp musical fantasy with a confused story redeemed only by Olivia Newton-John, high spirits and several strong scenes involving Kelly, I think we're going to go into that. They also did mention that Ebert actually criticized the choreographer, saying the dance numbers in this movie do not seem to have been would have not been conceived for film. It all feels too stagey.
But again, I think that touches on the point we said before about, I think the problem is with the way in which it's filmed.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there were moments in it where I thought about the choreography he did and the work he did on Dirty Dancing. And I think that film's flawless choreography wise. And this had so many flourishes and moments from that. So he's not the bad guy in this situation.
No. And if the shots would have been planned correctly, I feel like it would have picked it up specifically. So I think it's when it's group choreography is where you miss it, because it's always, you miss everybody in the background. You're focusing too much on the people at the forefront. Whereas if it had done it from a different angle, a different take, you'd have seen everyone, particularly in my favorite scene, excuse me,
the dancing scene, the mashup scene.
Yeah,
I feel like we lose so much. I mean, yeah. There are a lot that I will say some camera angles in that scene are fantastic, particularly the crotch and butt shots.
a load of them. There was a fantastic twerking shot that I said to there myself, was, "Well done."
She's the one I want to be.
Absolutely,
she worked it. She totally worked it. But yeah, I'll have to agree. I think the biggest one of the things that made me we're gonna go to it as we go, but obviously it's the cinema. Photography in this is just dull. It's the most boring cinematography for a movie that just by its premise alone, which we haven't really got into yet, by the way.
No.
Once we'll go in a minute, is the most, you'd think it's the most high energy, most ridiculous, cheesy camp thing ever, but the movie is shot in the most boring, wide shots, long takes. Things do not seem exciting or have energy. So it's kind of like it's sleeping through the whole movie. See, it's a shame for that.
I completely agree. But I believe that two Electric Light Orchestra songs in there, I'm Alive and All Over the World, are shot just like music videos, and it just doesn't fit in with the
I've noticed that. I mean, obviously there is very much the bit where they're kind of going around like the film sets, where I guess obviously the premise is that they are maybe music video sets or something like that.
It's a movie, it's a photo shoot stuff, isn't it?
So I got that, but then you know, particularly the mashup scene. Even I don't know if it was just because we've got the Blu-ray that we were watching it on. The quality of the picture was just so much better there than in other scenes. So it like kind of felt like, I don't know, they'd got like a music video crew in to film that bit.
I really think and they did.
It was very, very, very odd. But I don't know. It's weird to hear that like you said, it started shooting back in 78 because the whole thing feels really rushed to me. And I don't know if that is because obviously they didn't have a clear direction as to where they were going, but I don't know. You could kind of tell when you say about the things of Gene Kelly, like doing his scenes on his own, you can tell that that was separate. And I don't know. I always thought the animated bit was maybe just because they'd run out of budget and they were like, okay, we've got another song here, but...
That's literally the thing. They literally said like they wanted to include another musical number, but they just couldn't know where to fit it in, so they just got Don Bluth to make the musical number. That's literally the reason.
Makes sense.
There's no other reason why the song's even there. It's not even relevant. Makes no sense to the rest of the plot if you really think about it. It's just a thing, and it's like, you know what? Fudge it. Let's get Don Bluth of all things to add a musical number in.
It's one of my favorite bits because it just reminds me of Thumbelina so much.
But that's the thing is, you can tell instantly that scene as Don Bluth style, because what it reminds me of a little bit is because he also made the video game. That what was it? I can't remember. Castle something. I can't remember it. Dragon's Quest or something like that. Mm. Where basically you've got, and it's the same art style. She looks exactly like the princess in the game, and the guy looks a little bit like the knight in the game. And going like, yeah, it's like, it's almost like Don Bluth said, look, I have a particular style of lady.
I draw. This is what's happening. Yeah.
It's true. Like if you look at Thumbelina, if you look at Anastasia, they're the same woman, really. They just put on a different wig and say, you're curvy and nice.
Why not? Absolutely, why not?
Obviously, it didn't do very well in terms of like reception in that way, but it did absolute gangbusters in with the soundtrack because oh my god, it reached number one in most places, number one hits all over the place with Magic, Xanadu, every single, nearly five of the six songs, reached number one.
I believe Magic was the first US number one. And Xanadu was the first UK number one. Absolutely phenomenal songs.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, the soundtrack is, I mean, it saves it, I think, almost. I think the music is just incredible. One thing I found out that I thought was quite interesting, though, because my other half was alive when it all got released. He said that the music came out quite a while before the film came out. So I think, and when I looked, I think it was number one here in like something like June or July, but the film didn't actually come out until August, which I found a little different. I mean, obviously they don't approach musicals that way now, I don't think.
That's because I think that was a decision mistake. To be like, I believe it was a decision to think, I don't think this is going to do well. So if people like the music, they'll go and see the film.
Yeah, 100%. Maybe.
They used to do that for a while, actually. Like whenever there was a hit, like in the 60s and 70s in particular, whenever there was like a hit song, they would launch the song 2 months before the movie would come out. So you already had the song in your head and go like, oh, that's the theme song to the new James Bond movie, or this is the new thing from there.
The musical, like getting, I suppose you could go and sing along and that would make sense. And like you said, Liam, I think it makes sense that you'd be like, I love the music, so I'm bound to love the film. And then you realize.
Yeah. And then I think you have to think, like, this is the thing in particular. This movie and this soundtrack was supposed to be the launching pad for Olivia Newton-John's solo career as an actress and as a musician. Because of how badly this movie did, basically, she didn't really do a lot of musical numbers ever since, or at least not in terms of starring role.
Well,
which is a shame.
This film did give us her thinking, I need everybody to love me again. I'm going to release Physical. So,
yes. After that, she didn't do anything that matched Let's Get Physical. Like, nothing matched, I feel. Like, she
Twist of Fate.
That's it.
Twist of Fate was pretty. I listen to Twist of Fate quite regularly. I love some Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah, but I feel like basically, like, Let's Get Physical is like the top of the mountain. Like, that's tip peak.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after it's like,
where do you go from
it?
There? Do you need a hang glider to jump off, basically? And she did not have that.
Bless her.
You know what's interesting, though? We've actually talked about the movie and production, some bits of the whole, but we haven't actually ever talked about the actual plot.
I mean, I think it's maybe easy to miss.
Well, I feel like it's quite a simple plot, I think. The story of a muse who comes to Earth, inspires a fusion dance club of 1940s jazz with 80s electric guitar and rock. She ends up falling in love. Her dad tells her she can't do that. And she's like, oops.
They've done it now. They're going to have to catch me.
Through the power of roller disco.
Yes.
Zeus is like, okay, you can.
All right, Daddy Zeus. All right.
Go on. You can have her. We'll let you go. You go and fall in love with a man whose favorite flavor of crisp is probably ready salted. His favorite drink is water.
I'm sensing that you don't really like Sunny.
His favorite flavor of ice cream is ice. I just think Sunny is the most. Like, it makes me laugh because there's dialogue in the film. Like, there's one bit where he wants to go chasing after Kira, the muse, Olivia Newton-John. I mean, who wouldn't? Yeah. He goes up to these women and he's like, I'm going to steal your bike.
I don't believe it. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, kid. Hey, what up? Where you going? Hey, you. Come on. Hold on. Oh, hey, listen, I got to borrow this. I'll bring it back.
Sure. If you bring it back in person.
You got it.
You're saying that to him. Okay.
It is the fact that he does just randomly steal a bike, though, as well, and then decides to just drive it off a pier.
No disrespect to the man, but, like, everyone around him is so much more attractive.
I mean, what Danny saw in him, to be honest, to invest. If I was Deborah Meaden, I'd be out.
Like, we're going, we're done.
Especially when he's like, you can have half.
I know, let's be partners.
They parody that in the musical because Danny says, you only get 25%, and that's if you can get it all set up in one day. So they kind of like parody it. So it's,
he's very trusting, isn't he, our Gene?
Yeah. but Gene is literally the light of this movie, honestly, for me.
Yeah.
muses. I love how the muses are introduced.
Oh, yeah.
Which is literally what your background is.
Yes.
It's absolutely hilarious and makes no goddamn sense. So we've got Michael Beck, a.k.a. the guy from The Warriors, a.k.a. Mr. Blandy McBlandbland. He's trying to draw something, and I don't know what it is. He gets upset, realizes that being a freelance artist is hard work. Because of course it is, and just chucks the shredded paper out into the wind. It dances around and then hits a mural that's just conveniently in the middle of, like, you know, basically California Way.
Yeah.
And then happens to be a mural of the muses. Like, it's so very convenient. And then the paper touches them. They get a warm glow, and then they just dance.
Dance. They turn into Power Rangers at one point when they go into the air. One of them takes a run across the Hollywood sign and lights it up.
Oh, I love it. It's the campus thing. When they jet into the sky and it's literally the pride flag.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I've never thought of that before. Gay rights.
I will say... Sorry.
No, there's one muse. There are two muses in particular that I'm obsessed with. And I'll... go on. There's the main one who's like the oldest one, who's like leading the dance troupe. And then there's this beautiful lady in green here who I'm obsessed with.
Yes. And she's the one with the knot.
Yeah, she's the one I wanted to be.
Top knot Tessa. She's gorgeous. Gosh.
Like, everybody gets this cool thing. Some of them are running on a beach. One of them's running across the Hollywood sign. The poor lady who has to just run up some stairs.
And then she's just a glowing light.
She's like, I give up on this. I'm knackered. I'm just going to shoot through the stairs.
Do you know what's funny is? I bet she was like the muse of fitness.
Oh, yeah. She probably was. Yeah. This was a 500 staircase.
Going up some stairs.
One of the greatest parts of this scene, actually, is this thing itself. It's absolutely gorgeous. If I could get somebody to paint this on my hands.
The mural
itself is absolutely stunning.
I will say a couple of things. I absolutely love films that start with people making a wish, shredding up said wish, and then throwing the paper into the winds. Love that. So 100% I was in. I also really, really loved how diverse the muses were, especially for this being a film from the 80s.
One of the reasons why I think this film holds up so much is because if I go and watch a film from my childhood and I go and watch a film from my 70s, 80s, early 90s, I find myself bracing myself for somebody's going to say something racist, homophobic, transphobic in a second, and I know it's going to happen. Yeah. This film doesn't.
No.
Mm. No, it's surprisingly wholesome in that sense.
It really is. It is really wholesome. Absolutely, it is. But I love this whole sequence when the muses come alive. I mean,
and it's like I'm Alive by Electric Light Orchestra. The guitars are thrumming, and we get Kira showing that she's the young, naive one by covering her eyes and opening up, and then.
Basically doing the Pulp Fiction dance, in that sense.
Olivia Newton-John was really scared about this whole film with how much dancing was involved in it, because she wasn't like a dancer.
She wasn't a dancer.
She was a singer. So during this scene, she said it was the scary, apart from the scene where she does with Gene Kelly.
Can you imagine the nerves you'd have having to do a dance scene like one on one?
I don't feel like it shows at all. I don't feel like
no. I think she's just great.
I think she's absolutely
great.
A force of nature, Olivia Newton-John.
I mean, she definitely tries. She definitely tries. But I just feel like, to me, it almost seems slightly. I mean, filling that in, it makes sense that she was terrified because she is. She's actually supposed to be the muse of music and dance.
She's supposed to be the muse of dance, which really makes me laugh.
She barely dances.
She shakes what her mama gave her.
You'd think she'd be the muse of music in this, but apparently it would make sense.
One thing I do want to ask, though, which is obviously another big plus for me, and I don't know if this is a gay thing, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm so into my Greek mythology, Egyptian mythology, everything. So as soon as I realised that this was like every other gay I think out there, I was like, yes, Greek mythology.
What is it with queers and mythology?
It's like, the strong women. Into it. It's the strong women. We had Medusa before we had RuPaul. That's I'm gonna say
Marusa.
Oh no, she better don't
cut that out.
You serious?
Marusa.
Oh my god. Marusa.
Oh. I mean, it starts so strong. I mean, you know, if like, I think the rest of the film was like on this level and like,
and
I don't know. And I mean, the song makes some sense here. Like I'm alive and them coming to life. I think that's the other issue I had with the film was the fact that a lot of the songs don't always necessarily match the scenes. They're great.
Well, the reason why is because a lot of the Electric Light Orchestra music was not, other than the song of Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John, were not originally designed for Xanadu. They were designed for a completely different musical that didn't come through. So they just kind of say like, well, we've got all this cool music. Can we use it? It's like, sure. And then they're like, yeah, if you, it's like, yeah, we'll do that. But that means you're going to have to do our theme tune. Sure.
That
Why
makes
not?
Sense. They have, that makes sense.
They have this music sort of there and they want to use that. So yeah, it makes sense to that. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the art, This kind of then introduces, obviously, can I just say that the art, the actual painting and artwork, like you mentioned with the mules, actually really solid, because we realize our Mr. Blandy McBlandbland is an artist, a very unique artist who this is such a niche thing.
It could only exist in this time period as well.
Yeah, it has to be late 70s, early 80s, where it says, well, I paint murals of album covers so that record stores can have them up on their wall.
That is such
a niche job.
It absolutely is. And this leads me on to another pet peeve as well that I have in films. And this film perfectly does it. I hate when you have an actor playing an artist and they basically just stroke a dry brush over an existing painting. I cannot get on board with the fact that he does not even add a highlight, a brush stroke, anything to any of these murals. It does me in. I was very vexed.
Do you know what's very funny? Is because in the movie, the reason why, I mean, he's forced to go back to this job because he realized being a freelance is hard. So he goes back begrudgingly. Yeah, I know it's true. I know it's not true. Too close to home, everyone.
You went a bit Petty Marshall then. I loved it.
Being a freelance is hard.
It's been hard. But point being is that he has a bit of a bard and goes to the place. And the funny thing is, he's supposed to be the free-spirited one. He's the one that's going, oh, I just want to do my own thing. I am the pure artiste. But he never sounds it because he sounds like he's tired all the time.
He gets outshined in his own little scene there by his co-workers. The one he's like counting him down, she's like, 3.5 minutes.
I love his co-workers. I want to work so bad.
Yeah.
They look like the greatest group of people.
One of them looked like Farrah Fawcett, and I had to double check that it wasn't her.
Yeah.
I know, it's the hair. Yeah, it's the hair.
Great hair.
everyone in there has more personality than he does, but he's the lead, so we all have to bounce off.
Including his manager.
Would you like to visit his office?
Yes, I would.
He's a very strong and powerful man.
Xanadu.
Yes, please.
Oh dear.
I love how the manager basically comes in and says, look, I gave you the things, just do the job, please.
It's not an unreasonable request.
Can you do the job, please?
Last one in, first one home.
Hey, it's Sonny.
It's Michelangelo Malone.
Michelangelo, glad you're here. The ceiling needs painting.
All right, that's enough.
Well, the great Sonny Malone returns to Airflow Records, welcomed by cheering throngs of thousands. Art world fails to suffer. News at 11.
Cut it out. You know I wouldn't come back to all this unless I had to.
So what happened?
It's what didn't happen. No bread. I fought it, that's for sure.
Don't worry.
I spend my whole life painting what other people want. I paint his van, I paint somebody else's mural, I paint Simpsons album covers. Then, when I finally quit to freelance, not only do I almost starve to death, but I can't figure out what I want
to
do.
Ah, Luca decided to drop in. Where's your white flag?
You have a way with words, Simpson. You know that?
Same old wise-ass attitude. I thought we discussed this on the phone when I decided to take you back.
We did. But I have one question. Why the hell did you take me back?
Simple. You're good. And you're the fastest painter around. But this time, no more artsy, craftsy Sonny Malone touches, huh? Just enlarge the album cover the way I give it to you. Am I coming in loud and clear?
Olivia Newton-John, the muse, is on roller skates and just randomly sees him and just kind of randomly kisses him and then goes away in a bolt.
Without consent. Right?
Which without consent. And it just happened. And
that's so a Xana dance.
Yeah. There's the problematic nature of the film.
Consent.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is that he sees it as nothing. So, oh, that's a bit weird. Until the manager gives him, this is your next album to cover. And Olivia Newton-John is on the cover and going, wait a minute, I just met her quite literally about 5 minutes ago and kissed me.
Fun fact, the album is by a band called The Nine Sisters and there are nine muses who are all sisters.
Ooh, oh,
insert Twilight Zone theme tune here.
I thought you were going to stop at Twilight.
It's not a Twilight, no. See, there's a now I know why I got you on. Yeah. Because you're going to fill me with all the facts I haven't been able to find. So the rest for half the movie, basically, it becomes a sort of weird, kind of obsessive stalker situation where I need to find this woman.
Yeah, 100%.
It is stalkery because there are some bits that didn't make me laugh because he does bump into her several times. There's a bit in the pier where we meet Gene Kelly anyway, where he just turns, sees her, and then just flies off the pier.
He doesn't just fall though, does he? He full on, like, I mean, I think she was wanting to kill him at that point. I think the dark cut of this film is Olivia Newton-John like shot him at death ray or something and he flew off the pier.
Woo! You're a real whale, Flint, kid. What other stunts do you do? Man, this whole thing is screwing me up.
What whole thing?
Oh, no.
Come on, have a cup of coffee.
But then that does lead us into the introduction of Danny Maguire, who's playing his lovely clarinet on the beach, as so many do. He lets us know that he's retired. It's a nice way of saying he's a bum, which he says in the film. And him and Sonny bond over a cup of coffee, which is really nice.
Personally, I would never see these two ever match together as actual friends. But I will say this. It's Gene Kelly just being the sweetest man ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just the most wholesome. Every time he speaks, I'm my heart melts a bit. Because same. I feel warm. Oh, you are so sweet.
He's the real magic of this film. He really is.
My favourite scene in the movie is when Gene Kelly actually takes Mr. Blandy McBlandbland back to his place.
Oh, what a house.
He said, this used to belong to a silent movie actor, you know, and all that stuff. And just showing off his music collection, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just being pleasant. And he is kind of like, and Mr. Blandbland's like, meh, you know, whatever. And it's like, oh, is that the muse? Oh, wait a minute, that's like my muse, but very blandly and bland.
That sound was a miracle.
Hey, Danny, that's you.
Yeah. This girl. Danny, there's this girl.
Shh, shh.
Listen. That's me.
Hey, that's all right. You got any more surprises?
This is what I call my memorabilia room. It's sort of the story of Danny Maguire.
Tommy Dorsey? Benny Goodman? You really knew those guys?
Yeah, we used to all hang out together.
Why don't you give it up?
Oh, it was one of those turning points where you turn in the wrong direction. It was a girl.
The girl in the album?
Yeah. Singer with a band. When she left, I figured she'd be back, and I was about to run after her, right? Boy, did I teach her a lesson. Never saw her again. After that, the heart went out of my music. I went into the family construction business and became what they call comfortable. 3 cheers for comfort.
You ever think about going back into music?
No. Only about 20 or 30 times a day.
And so when he goes, so when Mr. Blandy goes, and then he just, there he is sitting down, reminiscing, playing his record, listening to Olivia Newton-John basically singing the tune. And then you see the superimposed sort of like
Glenn Miller
background band, of the bandstand and him getting up and then dancing. The whole sequence, that sequence is the one he did in private. Mm. And it's one of the most, it's one of the most heartwarming sequences.
Just them singing and dancing together and taking not just himself, but the whole audience back to that era. And using Gene Kelly, who was the musical star of that time as well, with the simplistic tap dancing, but how much energy he puts into it. It's absolutely mind-blowing when you think about, God, this would have been his first dancing, singing role in a while. And his vocals as well, his vocals haven't faltered.
They're great.
Oh, it's such a beautiful little scene. The chemistry between them both in that scene as well. She's got a smile on her face the whole time, and I think it was a genuine smile.
She said, hasn't she, quite a bit, like, since that it was a career highlight for her getting to do that. And I mean, I can't see how it wouldn't be.
No.
But I think this is what also makes the film maybe a little bit more disappointing, that it was such a flop, was the fact it had all these ingredients. And like, even the older people would have been pulled in at this point, you know, who'd maybe grown up with Gene Kelly would have been pulled in to see this.
That's, and that's where it comes from with me. I first watched this with my great nan, and she was she was the person who got me into musicals. And she loved this film, really loved it because of Gene Kelly. And that's why this film means a lot to me, because it's just like, my great nan was my best mate and she got me into all this. So watching this together, this scene in particular, I weep every single time I watch this. It makes me so emotional. And that's what my nan was saying. She remembers when it came out, and the predominant people in the audience were all like seniors and older people.
I can imagine.
So I can imagine it being quite bizarre then, if you go to the cinema and watching it, like, say, and you say, I'm here for Gene Kelly. And then you're like, what's with all this weird, what's with Mr. Hair?
Skaters.
What's with the weird raunchy 80 neon rollerblading thing? This movie, looking at Gene Kelly, I feel like this is what the movie should have been. It should have been Gene Kelly based. The story should have been more about Gene Kelly being reconnected with his muse, which happened to be Olivia Newton-John about 40 years before, and then feeling inspired to get back into music again. Mm-hmm. That's what it should have been.
Yeah.
It should have had nothing to do with Mr. Brandy McBlandpants.
But then he should have had like a young protege who's like, oh, you need to be a bit more hip and all this stuff, and that would have been cool.
Which could have been Blandy McBlandbland. It makes all the sense in the universe.
I think they were definitely obviously going for like almost a father-son dynamic, I think, with these two characters, but Sonny is just so uninteresting. it's just difficult because I don't know. I obviously there is really this very real collision of worlds and perspectives that's going to happen in the film. And I suppose that's the whole point of it. You're supposed to have the 40s meets the 80s, but his ideas of the 80s are just not it.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. The bit where he says, oh, this is the 80s and stuff, is always like, what is it? Superimposed? AD or whatever. Yeah. Because they had no idea what the 80s was going to be like at this point. I mean, at some point, I feel like they did nail especially on the mural itself with all the neon.
Oh, yeah,
all the
neon.
But nobody knew what the 80s was going to be like at this point.
No, absolutely not.
Leg warmers.
Apparently it was going to be so fucking raunchy because that musical number was hot. Everyone was rubbing everyone for no fucking reason.
See, stage over there and stairs there and there and back there. And kid, can you imagine it?
Imagine what?
A bandstand right over there in that corner. And a big band like in the 40s.
No. Bandstands went out with running boards. Over there, a great rock and roll band. This is the 80s.
Real
real smooth dancers, wild trombone, the band decked out in tuxedos.
Six guys wearing electric orange, synthesizer, heavy percussion, electric guitar.
He has no right to say this, but it's like the 80s is going to be six men in electric orange playing guitar. It's going to be surrounded by like club kids from the 80s wearing these fantastic outfits, yes, and stuff. That's what it's be. And then we get this gorgeous bit where it keeps flitting between the two
this
ideas.
This is really nice.
And, and then we get like a pastiche of the Andrews sisters, and we get Olivia Newton-John harmonising with herself in this gorgeous little song saying Forget About the Blues Tonight, which is then cut to the 80s and the Tubes are singing.
I also want to talk about in the 40s bit, that woman's spine in the at the start.
Yes!
The woman...
Incredible.
The woman that he basically just dunks her like a witch tea biscuit several times.
It's amazing.
I love it. That dance sequence, like the choreography in that dance sequence is absolutely gorgeous.
It's great stuff. I mean, to me, the thing that I found the most impressive in that sequence is when they finally kind of converge and the music finally merges together and they look at each other, they have like a dance-off, and then the sets from both the
such
40s
cool
band
idea.
And the 80s stage literally merged together.
I've literally got goosebumps as you're describing it. It's my favourite scene from the film. It makes me emotional when I hear it. Like, I well up when it comes on, and I'm like, this isn't even a sad song or anything.
It's just incredible.
It gets me choked up.
See,
it's gorgeous. But
that's the scene that proves to me that if with a little bit of better cinematography, a little bit more passion to it, a little bit more time, this movie could have been the most epic, beautiful thing.
Yeah. If the film was more that and not just like a film to like market Electric Light Orchestra's music, which isn't a bad thing necessarily because they make great music, but if it was more of that, it's like every now and then we get like a 40s show tune and then we'll get a rock tune and then that bit where it blends together, if more of the film was like that, I feel like it would have worked a lot better. I mean, because it still blows my mind now when I every now and then I'll just whack it on YouTube because I just want to hear it.
It's production value.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's the choreography again, and I keep going back to this, but even in the 80s bit, we mentioned we've got the guy in the electric pink leotard with the huge codpiece.
Love it.
Yeah, it's hard to
avoid. The lady in the zebra print leotard. Yeah, everyone, that woman who's just sitting on top of the drum players.
Or
shoulders
and the woman who gets plugged into the soundboard and just goes,
You say yes! I forgot about that bit.
There's a guy in it, the bassist in the band really looks like Ezra Miller.
That.
And I've never noticed it before.
Yeah.
So I was like, God, he's gone from terrorizing Hawaii to terrorizing his buddy Xanadu now.
He's gone backwards in time and decided to learn the
Flash.
Flash.
I see what you did there.
That's the plot of the next Flash movie.
He goes back.
Do you reckon this was the song that he was singing in karaoke when he got arrested? He was singing this.
My favourite bit of dialogue in this film is he goes in and he hears Magic by Olivia Newton-John and he's like, oh, I need to see what's going on there.
You.
Me.
I'm like, you bad bitch.
Look at you being sassy. I love that.
Yeah.
That whole first confrontation, like first meet, is so bizarre because it's almost as if like she's so playing coy is hilarious because every single response is like, well, do you want me to or not? I'm no need to do anything. I'm me, and I'm just enjoying myself. Fantastic.
I just love the fact that she does just casually disappear every now and then jump scare, she's back.
Yeah. Very cheeky.
That's why gay men love this so much. It's just a brief encounter and then we fuck off on roller skates.
This was Grindr before Grindr.
You say that, but then, if that scene in particular, they'll disappear for a minute and then they come back again. It's like, hi, do you want to catch up?
I am 0 feet away from you.
Yeah, I'm sorry I ghosted you. I didn't mean to.
Oh my God, it is. It's the representation of ghosting. That's what that whole scene is. Wow.
Just to clarify, saying what the building is. The building is actually called the Pan Pacific Auditorium in Los Angeles. Was used for the exterior. It was used for predominantly a lot of stuff, basically. But it was somewhat abandoned after a while. But they tried to refix that afterwards and everything. All the inside of the club though wasn't in the place. That was only the exterior. The inside was actually done in the Hollywood Center Studios, which is a shame. I would have liked to have actually seen if the inside actually matched the outside, because the outside was weird looking.
Very odd.
Unfortunately, here's the thing. The building itself would have later been consumed by a fire a decade later.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's literally, like, when I found that out, I was heartbroken, because it's one of those landmarks in the world that I would love to go and see. But
I mean, you can still technically go to the address, but stand there, go to the, there's like a car park now. It's like, I remember with this.
I was going to say, I bet it's like apartments. Yeah.
I'd love to recreate that album cover. The Nine Sisters album cover, just me on roller skates
with you alone with a glow rainbow in the back and a big fucking auditorium in the back.
This sounds strange, but there wasn't supposed to be a model on this cover. I snapped maybe 100 shots. In one of them, this girl just jumped into frame. The next time I saw her was on the contact sheet. I liked it, so I used it, and that's the whole story.
She just appeared.
No, appeared and disappeared. Now don't you go spreading this around. This is one of my best covers. Why do you want to know who she is anyway? I like her.
Well, this is it. The photographer's like, oh, it wasn't even supposed to have someone in, but then she just appeared. And then I'm like, what? So she appeared and optical effects were applied and she was perfectly, like, composed in the shot. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
I love how the photographer in that scene says that. Basically, she's like, it's like, there was a plan. She was there. I took it. That's it. Like, it's like... No one has consent in this movie. No one asked.
Did she sign a release form? No, she did not.
She didn't. And apparently, the manager and everyone else said, like, well, you know, she didn't sign anything. She didn't get paid. If she didn't get paid, she doesn't exist.
This film is a commentary on capitalism too. I mean, layers.
Oh, so many layers. Where it turns out, basically, that she's been there for too long because she's fallen in love with Mr. Blandy McBlandbland. And by this point, you'd assume there's some kind of weird magic stuff going on, right? Mm-hmm. Some weird sign of magic happening. But he doesn't believe it at all. He's like, you're not amused. What are you talking about? And then you get this weird sequence in the house with the TV.
With the gangster movie from the 40s.
Yeah.
What do you think, Sonny?
What was that about?
It's the bit that, to me, it's fine until she, to the, like, I think you need a drink. She's like, I'll do it, thanks. And it's like,
that completely took me out of it. It made sense until that bit. And then she's like,
But my favorite bit is where she appears and they go, Brenda.
She's like, hello.
I absolutely howled. Brenda. Of all the names that she could have, it's Brenda. Oh.
Well, well, look who's here. Who's chasing you this time, Vargas? The cops or the mob?
Don't get smart with me, Nick. I told you to stay away from Brenda Trent.
Ah, yes, you did tell me. What should I do, Sonny? Dive at him or make a martini?
What? Who are you talking to?
Sonny Malone. He doesn't believe Kira's a muse.
How can you be talking to me? You're a movie. I ain't got time for this, Malone. Brenda's the only one that saw me at the racetrack. Now, if the lady says she's a muse, she's a muse. Who's that? Brenda. Kira.
Sonny.
I think he needs a drink.
It's okay, I'll take care of it. Thanks.
Good luck on the opening of your joint, kid. Wish I could be there.
But yeah, that's the reveal. And she's like, I'm a muse.
Deal with it.
And he's like, I don't believe you. And then she's like, well, I'm going to make some weird shit happen. And then I'm going to disappear. Ciao.
Ghosting.
And then, yeah.
Literally ghosting at this point.
And then he goes like, he's like, oh, what do I do with my life? She's gone. So he just skates around Los Angeles. And he's like, there's a brick wall there with her painting on.
Yes.
I'm going to full force just skate to hell into this
wall.
If
he wasn't dead from the pier incident, this will do it. Yeah,
he wasn't dead from the pier, this would have done it. And somehow he thinks that's a normal thing to do. He's thinking, if I roller skate head on about 20 miles an hour into this wall,
it's just, I'll there's find a lot of leaps taken.
The power, aren't there? Yeah. The power of movies compels it to happen. Yeah. But
this is the thing. It's funnier in a degree because he, as he's getting back all depressed and forlorn and saying like, and also because Gene Kelly meets up with him at some point and say like, I was like, you know, 50-50, we got the club going. We're gonna get ready. You need to come tonight. It's like, it's not the same without Kira, blah, 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 Mr.
He's so mardy. I'm like, this old man is literally built this place, given you half of it, gone into a partnership with you, and you're like,
how much money's gone into him doing this?
And you're just fucking idiot. Nothing that just that had like three musical numbers with Olivia Newton-John.
It's just the audacity, the audacity of this man.
That bit leads us into my least favorite musical number.
Yes,
and where Mount Olympus is now a room with neon orange glowing lights on the floor.
It's just a shit tron.
And it's a negative of tron. Yes. Zeus is like, hello, Sunny.
What's he
what like, is the voice?
Yeah, I was like looking, I was like, that voice really sounds familiar, but then I realised it just sounds like a generic like 1920s like, and that horse comes in the ring.
So you see, you cannot go out with one of my daughters.
And then out of nowhere Hera comes in and she's like, oh, come on, don't be such a nub. And he's like, no.
We can't have...
Let my daughter see.
Yeah, it's like, we can't have Mr. Hare over here doing the thing. He needs to go. Goodbye now. Bye. And then...
I mean, they were looking out for their daughter's best interest because they're like, I'm not being funny. In one point, she's like, Shakespeare's written sonnets about us. You know, Beethoven's composed symphonies for us. What's Sonny done?
Sonny has quite literally just barely helped.
Sonny took a shopping. Into a magic
shop. I
want
to talk about this because that is, I think that bit is my favourite bit of the film. All over the world, playing Gene Kelly, just having a fashion extravaganza.
This film has so many tropes of everything, like tropes that I love in films. It has an animated sequence. It opens with a song and a dance. It's a musical. It's an 80s film. But also it has a shopping makeover montage. Like,
before that was even really a thing as well.
One of my favourite film tropes, and it's set to Electric Light Orchestra. Mm. There are drag kings and drag queens in that sequence. Yes. There's a Spider-Man lady.
You know who that is, don't you? The Spider-Man lady is...
Are they from Fright Night?
From Fright Night.
Is it the person from Fright Night 2?
Absolutely, yes.
Ooh. Okay, it all makes sense. Absolutely, it all makes sense now. In my head. Yeah. In my head, yeah.
Yeah.
What a face. absolutely.
A nice little tidbit about that moment is when they go into the dressing room and it's just that woman's legs
opening. I love that sequence.
Incredible. I want that built in my house. But also, she appears in that montage as well as a person.
Which one?
Love it.
She's actually in the outfit she wear, like the thing wears. If you watch it again, which you should. At the end, before it zooms into Sunny and Kira slow dancing together, you see her in the crowd. Imagine how weird it would be as a person to be like, I'm dressed like this. And over there, there's like a 20-foot version of me where when her legs spread open, people can just come out of it.
Not anyone. Gene Kelly comes out of it.
Gene Kelly comes out of it.
Gene Kelly.
What a testament.
That sounds like a fever dream.
Johan, this whole film is a fever dream. That should have been the tagline, an 80s fever dream, and that's it.
Make it seem I'm so so close to my dream, and then suddenly it's all there.
Suddenly, the wheels are in motion.
But we've also, like, before we've got to All Over the World as well, there's another dance music sequence that we glossed over, and that's Suddenly with Olivia Newton-John and Cliff Richard. I nearly called him by a different name.
Well,
then.
Cliff Richard, as in not really Cliff Richard, but Cliff Richard was, I'm surprised at this, because Cliff Richard was also in the running to play Sunny at some point.
Mm.
But,
no.
Yeah, which, honestly, it makes a bit of perfect sense. I mean, have you not seen Wired for Sound? It just makes all the sense in the universe for Cliff Richard, who's already playing pretty well with roller skates, to be in this movie.
I love that. I love this song. Yeah. I love Suddenly. I think it's gorgeous.
Suddenly is great as a song, as a scene. It feels very odd because
it's so weird.
Everything shot on a wide, which is slightly disappointing. But then I'm sitting there going, if this is supposed to be like for photo shoots and for music videos, the sets here are bananas. Like the train one, where did that come
from?
Yeah,
love that. The one that gets me is, it's obviously a nod to Singing in the Rain. Yes, obviously. But I was like, that's Rihanna's video set for Umbrella right there.
I just like the rooftop scene where the chimney just plops down and then just emits smoke. I'm like, that's yes, all I need. Yeah. That's all I need in a film set.
There's a bit in the Oasis that all the palm trees just come up for no reason. The train gets me all
trees
the time
erecting.
Because there they are. Just, yes. I love how half of them. I mean, Sonny should already know this studio, but he's already doing the dancing, sitting there on the bench, and suddenly he knows there's a prop train behind him, and he still acts, oh no, and it runs away, and all of the steam comes out at once. All the steam.
It's when the boss comes in at the end and he's like, do you know how much this stuff costs? And I was literally thinking the same. I was like, this guy's literally pressed these buttons and spent thousands of pounds.
Oh, this is the budget. Say, that booth that he's in is so
crystal
chic.
Maze.
Yeah.
Crystal
it's
maze.
So chic. It was Crystal Maze meets Bill and Ted's
yes.
Excellent.
That's what it is. Oh, that's what it
that's
is.
That's a crossover we need.
Excellent!
It reminded me, for any Doctor Who fans out there, it looked like the old Emperor Dalek.
Ooh. Yes.
Like neon.
100%. Yeah.
So it's just love the fact he goes and he presses. There's fireworks literally happening in the background. And then it says, let's just dance in this very expensive thing that we've just started.
In
but
skates.
The fact that he knows it's Sunny and he just doesn't straight up fire him at that point
because
as well.
He's the fastest painter in all the land.
Movie magic.
Maybe just one moment, darling.
Well, maybe just one moment. Or forever. I keep getting them mixed up, too.
We go from Mount Olympus to Xanadu itself.
Oh.
And it's just
the come down of the century. No, I'm checking.
No. We've just had like this low energy ballad. Yeah. And then the drums start pounding. The skates are rolling. And we are introduced to absolute chaos. We get a whole tour of the club. Of Xanadu in all of its
with
glory.
Gene Kelly at the front of the conga line.
Gene Kelly's there on roller skates, and you're
do
like,
"Do you guys know how old he was when he filmed this? 68, 68 years old on rollerblades, leading the pack,
doing great."
What's brilliant about this is before we get to see Gene Kelly in all of his glory, we get to see the absolute chaos of the club. We've got like people on stage who I thought were going to be club attendees. But no, everybody, through the power of musicals, knows how to do dance and stuff. We get this incredible woman at one point with, like, Rick James hair. Just
is it in front of the mirrors? Is she the one?
Yes!
Yeah. Every time I watch it, I look out for her. Yeah.
And here's the thing. It's like we kind of mentioned near the beginning of the movie. This is the bit where every single musical genre ever is represented here in some shape or form. You've got the men in the zoot suits in one particular corner, right, and doing the tap dancing sequence and moving away. You've got literally the 70s rollerbladers going around the ring. You've got the 80s punks hanging on, like, standing on top of tables, looking down and doing doing that. Everyone's got an actual position, all clapping and just saying Xanadu like some kind of weird fucking cult tribe. It is cult. Wonderful. It is cultist.
Sign me up.
But then we get one of this movie's transitions, and I mean, it has many. It was like it was made on Microsoft PowerPoint when it was doing the transitions. But then we get an ex. She's in. Olivia Newton-John comes in a gold cat suit and sings the titular song.
Yes.
And then she takes a break and she's like, here are my sisters. Brings the muses in. We get an electric tap dance routine.
Yes.
Which then leads into my personal favorite. They're all decked out in tiger costumes. One of the best songs from this is Olivia Newton-John saying, "You're a fool. All you do is remind me that you're a fool."
Yeah.
She never released that as a full song, which really upset me.
So good.
We then go, then another tonal shift. I'm sure I should pass a lonely down. Suddenly get transported to the Wild West.
Why is she doing a country number?
I don't know. She wears this fabulous. Oh my god, the fringe on that. And then my favourite bit of that sequence though is where she taps on the bar, and the beer comes up to her. She takes not even a sip of it. She just dips her nose in it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not really drinking.
Puts it down, pulls a face to camera.
Yes.
Goes back on stage, finger guns the camera, and then we get the muses in. This weird 80s like white number. Olivia Newton-John makes her grand return to the stage wearing the greatest outfit in the world. It's a gold lamé high collared cape with blue tinsel in her hair.
See, I literally wrote down goddess mode, looks like a Power Rangers villain.
Yeah, that was like, that was the yassification of Rita Repulsa. The costumes disappear and they're all in their costumes again from the beginning. She reaches the high note at the end, disappears.
And this is a weird part for me. I love that bit. Everyone disappears, right? The club is suddenly silent. It's just Sunny in the middle of the room looking like, oh, sad. And then as he walks away, everyone just comes out again and just makes me wonder, where were you just a moment ago?
He goes to have a chat with Gene Kelly, and Gene Kelly's like, oh, what a night. I'm hammered. Blah, blah, blah.
Enjoy
it. He's
a drink.
Like, do you want a drink? And then Sonny's like, nah. And he's like, excuse me, miss. My friend would like a drink. Comes over. Who is it? But Kira, Olivia Newton-John. And he gets a drink of her, says, thank you. She goes to walk away, and he's like, no. And then it's just like a hi.
The awkward improvisation over the credits as the credits are rolling
you
and they're
see.
Having to get
watermelon banana.
But this
it's
is the
incredible.
Thing.
At that point, if you look at her mouth, I'm sure she's saying, I wish this was Greece.
You're no Travolta.
I wish you were John Travolta.
You're no John Travolta. But here's the thing though, right? Can someone elaborate on this for me just a tiny bit? Is it basically Kira? But in terms of Kira remembers everything, or is she always her brain completely wiped and now she's human? Because I don't
think
get
she
that
doesn't
sequence.
Remember because I'm sure because Gene Kelly says, do I know you? And she says no.
No, but she's saying no because she doesn't want him to know that she's a muse.
I didn't get that. I thought that maybe she's moved on.
She knows exactly who he is. Like she remembers him. Yeah. But this is the thing. What gets me is she didn't fall in love with Gene Kelly in the 40s, which Gene Kelly in the 40s was such a spice.
I know.
But somehow, Sonny, Michael Beck was the one to...
It's the legs. It's those short red shorts and his legs.
He must... I don't know if I can swear on this.
Yeah,
so
just swear.
I do
we've
apologize.
Already been swearing a lot anyway.
He must have been slinging dick like no tomorrow for her to be that dignitized by him.
I swear to God.
I mean, He must have been hung like Zeus himself.
I'll tell you something, right? This must be the other thing, because I'm looking at all he is, his hair and legs. Because even looking at some of the shots from behind, I sat there going, there is actually no butt there. He doesn't even butt. And you say to yourself, like, you don't even have a good figure. What's happening here?
When Gene Kelly's trying on his like outfits,
he's got curves.
He's still got an ass.
He's got a butt.
Yeah.
All the curves and swerves we need.
But no, the ending is Kira has been allowed to come back down to Earth, yeah. And she does remember him.
I kind of thought for a second that maybe would have been like sort of like. When she flew back up into the sky temporarily, she also just Men in Blacked everybody. Just like, right, you don't remember any of this. Let's go back to weird dancing.
I mean, imagine being at that club as well and just being like, what the fuck did they put in our drinks last night?
Did you see people flying?
Can you remember when suddenly I was wearing a cowboy hat? No, but I can remember when you were suddenly decked out in tiger print.
What happened there?
Oh, was that before or after the weird drag lady came on stage and everybody's costumes magically changed?
I'm just imagining this being like the best hangover conversation afterwards. Like, oh, what happened like that? I think everything happened last night.
This would make a great episode of X-Files, wouldn't it? Can you imagine?
You'd make a great episode of Black Mirror.
Absolutely, it would.
It reminds me, now looking back at it, now reminds me of a movie I've seen recently. There's a movie called Climax that came out a while ago. Basically, all the dancers, it's just like a dance club. They're all just friends and dancers, but they get incredibly high on ecstasy one night and they just go bonkers. And it's just a night. Like, I imagine that's what the opening night of Xanadu was like. They all woke up the next day going,
well, this is a point.
Fuck.
I don't do drugs and I don't partake in the use of drugs, but I feel like this is a film I would like to see kind of off my tits on. I do feel like it would change my life. Absolutely, I would.
Now officially ordering the magic mushrooms at the ready.
People who watch this film do it as a reading. There's like a fan theory that when Sonny drops into the water, he actually dies, and it's all like thing. But it's also Gene Kelly, Danny McGuire. Going through Alzheimer's.
Oh, no.
Just imagining it all.
Don't make it dark.
When you watch a film with that, it's horrible. I wish I never read it. It was like a Reddit fan theory, and I was like, you've just ruined one of my favourite films.
It's not even
of all
playing
time.
A clarinet. It's just driftwood.
I'm just having this hilarious sort of weird thing now where you see Gene Kelly at the end of the movie dressed up in a suit. He's in an abandoned building, these in the band auditorium, just stroking
just
around, going
jacket.
Like, Xanadu is wonderful. Where's my drink? Rollerblades. Cuts, credits. Wow. I'm going, shit, that's a way to end it. Ultimate ending, the secret ending.
Oh
my god. We've reached the end of this movie, basically, and had our discussion. So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to, especially because Liam Banks, you already know about the Trashometer.
I do.
So I need to introduce you, Liam James, to the Trashometer.
Trashometer.
If this is the first episode you've been listening,
God help you.
Joining us for Xanadu, thank you very much for that. That was a roller coaster. But we review things a little bit differently around here. We don't do A's or numbers or star ratings. We do something called the Trashometer. So what we do is we try and measure on a scale of how much we enjoyed the trash in the movie. And there's 5 points. We're trying to do a balancing scale. So at the bottom is tame. Tame basically means it's really boring. It's not really entertaining. It's right down the bottom. The trash wasn't enjoyable. Not like in a bad way. It was just bleh, just dull. We've had a few movies like that, like The Rock's, like Dwayne The Rock Johnson's Doom, for example. That was a snore fest. So out it goes, right?
Definitely
then
don't
got
love
tiny
that film.
Bit. So boring. I fell asleep twice. You then got tiny bit trashy. Tiny bit trashy means there are some good fun moments, but it could have been more. Like, it could have been more trashy. Like, it could have pushed it a bit more. We had enjoyable bits, but it wasn't reaching there. Right in the middle is trash. It's the perfect thing. It is the perfect musical number. It is the golden goose. It is the perfect combination of good and bad, right? You then got too trashy. Too trashy means even though we're enjoying it, we're now starting to get annoyed at it. The badness is really starting to get to us. It's really getting on our nerves. It's not, it's but we're still having fun with it, but there's moments going like, this is not fun anymore. And then there's torture. Torture means we pretty much hated it. It's all bad. The trash was no longer enjoyable. It was actually a slog to sit through. So that is what the trashometer is. So I'm going to ask both of you. We'll start with Liam James first. Where do you think this should fall on the trashometer?
Well, you nailed it while you're describing what the middle one is. Yeah. It's just trash. It's the perfect blend of awful but fun.
Yes.
And like no matter what happens, as bad as this film is, you can't watch this film and not have fun with it. Like, there's sequences. It's impossible, I think, to watch this and think, go, if you leave watching this film, there's no way you can think, oh, I didn't have a, like, I didn't bop my head to this bit, or I didn't, like, I haven't got the theme tune stuck in my head, or, oh, let's talk about this, like, animated moment. You don't leave, like, thinking, that was the worst thing I've ever seen, I hate it, let's never talk about it again. And it didn't, the reason why I say it's in the middle as well is it pushed boundaries, it didn't push them too far, and it didn't go too far in one way. It sat very comfortably in the middle of a spectrum of every single genre in the world. So that's why I think it's level 3, and it's just trash because it's perfect trash.
You know what? You've really convinced me on that one. I came on you today to say you need to defend this movie, and you know what? You've done a fantastic job there. Liam Banks, tell me, where would you put this on the trashometer?
I'd probably say too trashy for me. Okay. It's not torture by any means. Sure. But I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I found myself getting a bit annoyed with it in places. I think overall, like Liam said, I definitely left having had a good time. And I'd probably say it's not a straight 4. It's maybe a 3.5. It's on the way to 4, if that's allowed. Yeah. Just because... I just think there's just too much going on. I think it's trying to be too many things. And I think it would have really benefited from a strong script alongside everything else.
More time and effort.
Yeah, it's like there's so many elements I enjoy about it. I love the music. And absolutely, I'll sing along when I watch it. But
yeah.
I don't know. I know that there's so many other ways it could be better, which I think is what gets me, maybe. Sorry, Liam, because I do love you.
So this is what I think, actually. I feel like it's a kind of a combination of both of you. So I feel like if we're going to go we're level 3, I feel like it's on a high level of trash, where if it could, there could have been a couple of moments where if it was even, for some reason, I'm not going to say lazier, because it wasn't, but if there were a few moments that they went even worse, it could have gone to too trashy for me.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I've been hearing, I watched it last night for the second time. I watched it the first time years ago, right? And I'm literally walking down the street on the way to work, singing every single song on the way in.
Yeah, I mean, today I've been listening to it.
Remembering every single song, remembering every single dance routine, remembering every single bit, just bopping down today. It's stuck in my head. And it's because, all the bits that do shine really stick out, and the good's actually really good, and the bad is it's not offensively bad. That's what I feel. None of it's sitting there going, God, this offended me in some way or another. It's just a bit meh. But all the good parts stand out so much that I think this is trash too. I think this is the right moment. But if we're going to put it on the scale, right, let's say, for example, it's on high end of the trash bit. It could very easily have tipped over into too trashy. But through the power of magic or something, just keeps it all together. I actually couldn't find it online, whether legally or illegally, without like subtitles or in a different country. So I had to go on Amazon and buy this. And it cost me £5 on DVD to find this, right? £5. So I sat there going, is this going to be £5 worth of entertainment? And I said to myself, yes, because fact is that while I might not rewatch this every single month, I will for sure watch this and have a bit of a giggle if I just need a little bit of lifting up, I think.
But yeah, I'd say this movie works to me like a girl group works. You've got to have the good, the bad, and the not so great. Like Destiny's Child, you've got the Beyonce, you've got the Michelle. This is the Kelly Rowland.
Freddy!
Expertly done.
Why? You well done. You brought in the running joke.
See, I'd say this is a Michelle. For sure, this is a Michelle.
No! I would. Sure. I feel this is a Roland for sure.
Yeah,
it ain't Beyonce, no matter how much it tries. No.
I wish I had that, like, maybe that nostalgic approach to it. You know, like how you watched it as a kid growing up, and you, Johan, you'd watched it younger as well. I suppose I might have felt differently about it, having not watched it for the first time a couple of months ago.
See, so for me, obviously, I'll defend this with my life, not just because I enjoy the film so much, but it's so dear to my heart, this film. Mm. I mean, it was perfect for me because I was that kid who was into, like, rock music, and my nan was into, like grandstand band, all that kind of stuff, and classic musicals. So to me, it really holds a dear place in my heart. Mm. And big shout out to our Mags, rest in peace, because she fucking loved this film.
Bless her.
If you're trying to say it shyly, and it's a stain on the memory of my great man.
You have officially made it personal.
Wow.
No.
Signing off.
But I think. But on that note, I'm going to put this on the trashometer as a high trash. It's got to be
perfect trash.
High trash.
It's high trash. So, which is a whole mood, by the way.
Absolutely.
Just before we wrap up, basically, I would like you. Well, this is where we do our plugins, where basically everyone just sort of says what's happening on our socials or everything else. So, Liam's, what's happening on your side of the world? What's going on?
So, being professional homosexuals, we do have a very, very busy month lined up. So, June for us over at the There Queer podcast, we actually have three specials for the month of June.
Wow.
Three Pride specials. Liam and I have both each taken a film and presented it for us to both analyze. Mm-hmm. Myself, I couldn't choose a film that without it being the Blair Witch Project. If it's my choice, that's the one I want to talk about. Liam went kind of like the opposite direction and went for Death Becomes Her, one of the greatest films ever made. Yep. And we have a very special guest joining us to talk about another 80s cult classic film.
We've got a killer special guest smack bang in the middle of Pride Month, so you'll have to head over to our socials, I suppose, to
But the film that we are discussing with that is the 80s film Vamp with Grace Jones. That's what we can say about it.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, we went big. We went hard or we went home, didn't we, on this triple feature. But yeah, I mean, around that as well, we're going to have Stranger Things specials as well for the new seasons coming out. Mm-hmm. If you want to keep up to date with our episodes and who we've got on, I mean, we need to get you on at some point, Johan. Just follow us on Instagram, Twitter, the usual. We post our podcasts on YouTube as well. Just either Super Freak Media on YouTube or Their Queer Podcast Instagram or Their Queer on Twitter.
Excellent. Good. I can't wait now. The moment you said Vamp, I sat there going like, oh my
it's
God,
such Christ a good Jones episode. And I mean, the person we've managed to get on for this as well a big deal.
Yeah.
So we're very excited for this episode. But I mean, by the time this goes out, everyone will know who it is anyway. But we'll tease you some more, Johan, because
stop teasing me, people.
We'll be like Kira. We'll just be a little tease.
We'll just disappear. We'll roll away.
Me.
Me.
Oh my goodness, that's wonderful.
I think I want that as my ringtone. I just want
it. Oh, excellent. Oh, I love that to bits. Thank you very much. I'm dead excited now.
Thank you so much for having us on. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. It's a pleasure. I first heard of it when Liam was first on discussing Teeth, and I've been enjoying it ever since.
Oh, it was so awkward.
Your Malignant especially the Malignant episode you did together as well, you kind of like changed my mind on that film. I hated that film, but after listening to the Trash Tapes episode of it, I was like, okay, I can give it.
I am changing minds. Yes.
But we're recording this last night, was the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards, and it won
big.
The best feature there. So it did win big.
Mike Flanagan won big there as well, and we love Mike Flanagan. So Yes, Gene.
Oh God, I'm actually genuinely glad that people are liking the liking our show and that we're changing minds.
We absolutely love it.
Because there are some movies we sit there going, this is going to be difficult to try and sell. On time recording, we just had a new episode out where we talked about, since Bruce Willis is famously retired now, we decided to do Hudson Hawk, which is Hudson Hawk. So his weird passion project, musical number passion project, we decided to cover that one. Oh God, it was special. I tell you that one. We've also got in the works as well. Like the next episode after this is going to be Ed and I doing Mummy Dearest, which I can't wait. No wire hangers ever. It's going to be absolutely wonderful.
I'm not mad at you, I'm mad at the dirt.
And this is the thing, we're going to approach it differently because Ed and I are going to be doing this, but on the side, I'm actually going to be trying to talk to some actors to tell me whether or not Faye Dunaway's performance is actually good or not. We're going to analyse the shit out of this.
Because
I feel like it's one of the movies that as it's gone on, people have a very interesting approach to it and say, this is not, this shouldn't be laughed at. This is actually horrendous. But it is also a choice in terms of performance, so we are going to run with that.
I think what you folks are doing over here is fantastic, and as somebody who loves like quote unquote trash films and cult films, I love tuning in and listening to what you have to say, and I love the aesthetic of the whole thing as well. Yeah. That's right up my street. So yeah.
Although I'll tell you something, in some later episodes, I have been nicking some of your techniques that you've been doing on your side because I love your edits because they are so meme-y at points. I just feel like, God damn it, I wish I had the time and energy to make everything a meme because it's so good.
I mean, we're just walking memes at this point, aren't we, Liam? So.
Yeah, totally fair.
Yes, we are. All right. And so to officially sign off here on the podcast, we all like to say, keep an eye on your trash. There might be some treasure in there. See you all next time. Bye.
Bye now. Bye.
Barbara, please.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode and hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it around with movie lovers you know, maybe add a star rating or write a good review. All of this helps with the algorithm and provides us with more opportunities to reach the ears to a whole new bunch of bad film fanatics. Want to find out more about us? Then head over to our socials where we provide sneak peeks and up-to-date news on everything nostalgic and trashy. You can find our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages in the description. So please, follow us. See you next time, cinephiles.